From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise can help you manage your money in different currencies. With Wise, you can send money to your cousin in Australia in seconds. Travel internationally without having to brave an airport currency exchange desk or take the guesswork out of converting currencies. Wise lets you send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate, all without any hidden fees. Join 60 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account can work for you, download the app or visit Wise.com. That's Wise, W-I-S-E.com. Wise.com.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hey, it's Max. I've got a podcast recommendation for you. It's called The World As You'll Know It, and you should check it out. Here's a couple of reasons why. One, it's short. It's only 5 episodes. It's running right now. It finishes before the election. And two, the conversations are just fascinating. Here's what the show is about. It's about what this moment, what COVID is going to mean long-term for some of the biggest issues facing us. So climate change, the economy, and the format of the show is really interesting. They take journalists, David Wallace Wells, who's been on Long Form, who covers climate change, hosts the first episode, and the journalist interviews an expert in that field. So David interviewed Cristiana Figueres, who is the architect of the Paris Accord. And the two of them talk about what this moment is going to mean for climate change. It's only 5 episodes. It's running now through Election Day. The show is called The World As You'll Know It. Go check it out. Thanks to them for sponsoring the show, which starts right now. Hello. Welcome to the Long Form Podcast. I'm Max Linsky. I'm here with Aaron Lammer and Evan Radliff. Gentlemen, hello.
Hey.
Hello, Max. What have you got for us this week?
This week, I talked to Latif Nasser, and Latif was just named very recently co-host of Radiolab, along with Lulu Miller, who was on the show at the beginning of the pandemic times. Before he was the co-host of Radiolab, he was the head of research at Radiolab. Before he was the head of research at Radiolab, he was a fact checker there. And before he was a fact checker there, he was a PhD student at Harvard studying the history of science. And he started just pitching Radiolab blind. He'd never done journalism before. So we talked about that whole arc, but also how he finds stories and how he thinks about stories. We talked about being willing to be dumb. And we also talked about this podcast he did earlier this year called The Other Latif, which was about a prisoner at Gitmo who shares his name. It was a 6-part series. And then we also talked about another 6-part series that he did for Netflix, a TV show called Connected. The guy does a lot of stuff.
Got a lot going on.
We talked about it. I will say it was buoying, you guys. These are not good times, but talking to him was a good time.
If you need a good time that is good for you and good for people who want to read, start an email newsletter with MailChimp. Pretty soon, I think everyone is gonna have to have their own newsletter, so you can get a jump on them by establishing your personal newsletter brand early with MailChimp, who support the show.
And now here's Max with Latif Nasser.
Latif, hello.
Hey, hi. Thanks for having me.
Here we are, man. I've really been looking forward to this, and we had to like reschedule it because like kid shenanigans happened, and now I feel like we have a very tight window in which
because
to talk
of kid shenanigans. Also, I mean, not shenanigans. I just have to take over kid care. That is the reality.
You got to go take care of a baby.
Correct. Yeah, a baby who does not understand the concept of night. Or day, or sleep, or awakenedness. This baby is really, it's just, I think you have kids, kid?
I got two.
Yeah, it's just shocking to me. The biggest surprise is like how they come out knowing nothing, like nothing. You just like, it's like, oh, you don't know how to burp. You don't know how to eat. You'd really think some of those would be hardwired, but really it's like nothing.
So you are fully in the like, you are not sleeping right now.
Oh yeah, no, definitely not. No, I'm very tired right now.
Are you working?
Yeah. Yeah, I just started back from pat leave. But the idea we had was like, oh, sleep train right ahead of going back to work, then it'll be perfect. But then like what we didn't realize is the sleep training, like obviously that lasted longer and went way worse than we could have expected. And so now it's like sleep training and coming back to work at the same time. It's really a mess, but I'm not going to complain because there are many people in many, many, many worse predicaments right now.
For sure. Although it's funny thinking of you going through like sleep training, because I mean, you and I don't know each other, but I'm very familiar with your work. And my like concept of you, if you were like in the midst of sleep training, you would just be like researching the hell out of like the nature of sleep.
Oh, that's what I do. But it's exactly that. And babies and infant development, like there's so much stuff that's so interesting. And the idea of like, when I used to think about pain, I would think about this a lot, like which is like pain and crying, like they're both like these bodily alarm bells, you know? And they're not that good alarm bells. Like they don't always tell you the thing, like this baby is signaling problems that aren't necessarily really problems, or the baby thinks that they're problems, but I as a parent can be like, no, like you can't snooze or turn off the alarm, right? Like it's like pain, like chronic pain. That's the whole problem. Like it's like the body's alarm bell mechanism is like, hey, there's a problem here, but there's no problem there. It's like an alarm clock that's not working. But it's just funny to think about that theoretically, but then like when it's in the middle of the night and there's like effectively like a ambulance in your house, the siren going off incessantly, like it's hard to think about or research anything, to be honest.
Do you have like an on-off switch with that part of your brain? Like, are you in work mode and you're like, okay, everything in the world is interesting, and then like a non-work mode where you're like, I'm just gonna make some dinner?
No, I don't think I have an off switch necessarily. Like, I think it's, and for a lot of people, it's like, I mean, I'm so lucky I found my wife. For a lot of people, it's like unbearable. Like, they are like, it's like, it's not that interesting, actually. Like, let me just explain this to you, because it's just not that interesting. Like, you think it's interesting, but it's not that interesting. I feel like I have such a low threshold I feel like as a producer editor, I've had to like up my threshold, because otherwise I'd be just, everything would be a story and I'd be like, wow, and I'd be like, shut up, not interesting.
But you have learned to do that. You've learned to quell your own enthusiasms.
Yeah, or at least hide it, like be secretive about it a little bit, because it's like when you go into a pitch meeting or like we have like our editorial meetings where we decide what stories to do, and I'm part of that decision making process, and you can't just love everything, because then like it devalues the currency of your love, you know what I mean? So you just have to sort of pick your battles and really know that everyone else has a higher threshold for like wanting to spend an hour or two like noodling around and thinking about some random thing.
Well, are you saying that you actually do feel all that love? You just need to like mess with it for inflationary purposes?
Yeah.
Or have basically you actually learned to be like, no, that story is boring, despite the fact that I am sort of predisposed to think that everything is interesting?
No, I think it's, I still love it. Because I think that there's I mean, this is a thing you get told when you're a kid, you know, like, and I feel like I got told it once when I was a kid and it just stuck with me so hard. And I'm sure you got told this, everybody. Like when you're a kid and you're complaining, you're like, I'm bored. And then it's like, no. Like the world is not boring. It's, if you are finding the world boring, it's you that's boring. It's not about the world. The world is plenty interesting. And it's like, there are ways to unlock every story. There are interesting nuggets. There are angles. Like even the most cliche sort of tired story, there are angles. There are ways to do it that you can bring it back to life. And sure, some stories require a lot more like, you know, the defibrillators turned up way higher than others. But still, like I really do think that it's like, everything is interesting if you know the right angle, if you have the right framing, if you bring the right question to it.
Yeah, I guess I feel like in some ways that would be like exhausting a little bit, trying to figure out what's like, well, if I can unlock anything.
Yeah.
then how do I choose how to spend my time? Which is actually like one of the reasons I wanted to have you on, is I feel like just watching your sort of like work and career from afar, this like Netflix series dropped and I was just kind of like, when did he have time to do that? When did he have time to make a TV show? How does he do that? Where are these choices coming from? And you know, watch the Netflix show and like, there's just an episode on dust, which felt to me like an incredible flex. That was how it felt to me. It was just like, I'm going to name this Dust. And I think I just would never be like, I can find the thing that's interesting about Dust. In fact, Dust would be high on the list of things that I would say as a joke for what I was going to do a story about.
Well, partly like a bunch of the two of those stories in that series, one of the other episodes too, Digits, like that was also like a, like I pitched it, you know, and it was like, okay, we're going to do this 45-minute episode or hour-long episode about math and about like a math, like an obscure math law you've never heard of, huh? And then it's like just the idea of that, like it is kind of a dare, like it's a dare to myself, like, or a dare to the, you know, and I think like everybody on the team took it that way where it's like, okay, we could do this. We could do this. It's like, it's hard, but we could do it. But to your point, like, I do think it is a kind of, like, I guess my like low threshold for what's interesting, it is a weird curse in a way, because I have a lot of ideas. Many of them are terrible. Many, majority of them are terrible. But I fall in love with them and I get really excited about them. And then they sort of burn a hole in my brain and I need to get them out somehow. So I pitch a lot of stories at Radiolab. I've done some stuff in print. I've done some stuff in TV. I've done some stuff in other mediums, because it's just like, ooh, look at this shiny thing I found. Like, look at this shiny thing. Like, I need to tell the world, because otherwise it's like, it's just in my head and I can't. And sometimes a lot of the times they're really bad ideas, and I'm very grateful for good, gifted editors who tell me that my bad ideas are bad ideas. But it is a kind of a burden where I'm like, oh, why am I, like, it's okay. I can, this story, it's fine. Like, it doesn't matter. Like, it's not going to be a different, if I don't tell this factoid about paleo oceanography, like, it's like, it's fine, the world won't be substantially different, like, it's okay. But then I'll be like, oh, but I really, that would be so fun to just tell that to everybody. And it does take like people around me, really good editors, really good friends, really good my wife shoots down so many of my ideas, but people who are much more ruthless to be like, I'll just put that one in the drawer.
Was it a process for you at all to like accept and appreciate ruthlessness?
Yeah, because it hurts. Initially, it takes so much courage to like stand up in front of everybody and say, I love this. Like, this is interesting. This is going to blow your mind. Like, this was a thing that I feel like I learned in college, where it's like, it's so easy to hate everything and be cynical and just like, there's a kind of ease to that. It's actually, it takes a lot more courage to go up in front of everybody and be like, this is awesome. I love this. That takes a lot of guts, I think, because you just put like a piece of your heart on the table. And I really do feel that way. Like, every story is like a little piece of my heart. Every pitch, you know? And then they get stabbed. Like, and you're like, that's really horrible. But it does take a kind of, like, if it happens enough times, you build up a kind of resilience to be like, it's partly like, oh, these people are smart and they know what they're doing and I trust them enough to save me from myself. But it's also partly like, they're all idiots. I know, they don't know. This is so beautiful and interesting, but I'm not going to take the time and effort to persuade them, because I have another bright, shiny thing over here.
Right. I'll agree with them this time, although we all know deep down everything is interesting. I mean, I do find that like the image of you in a pitch meeting in which you were being pitched, sort of like secretly contorting yourself, like, to be like, I guess that's not for us, but it's very interesting.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so I guess it's not for us until the New York Times Magazine does a huge spread on it, and like, and we're all gonna feel dumb, but that's okay. That's all right. Don't worry about it. It's totally cool.
Wise is the app that makes using different currencies easy. Need to send dollars to your cousin in Bali fast? Getting paid in another currency and don't want to lose out because of inflated exchange rates? Want travel money without having to slog through the currency exchange kiosk? then Wise just might be your answer. From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise takes the guesswork out of converting currencies. You can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate, with no markups and no hidden fees. In 2023, people sent over $100 billion worldwide with Wise. What's more, over half of those transfers got to their destination in less time than it takes to listen to this ad. Whether you're traveling, spending money abroad, or doing business, let Wise help you manage your money in different currencies with ease. Join 16 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account can work for you, download the app or visit Wise.com. That's Wise, W-I-S-E.com. Wise.com.
Calling all female runners, it's time to lace up and join Team Milk. Since the 2022 New York City Marathon, Team Milk has sponsored female marathon runners nationwide, providing support and shining a spotlight on their unique stories, perseverance, and drive to go the distance. Why milk? Dairy milk is an excellent nutritional add for both marathon training and recovery. Milk contains 13 essential nutrients, including high-quality protein, making it a crucial component of a training diet. Plus, it's one of the best beverages for hydration, even better than water. The same electrolytes that are added to many of your favorite sports drinks are found naturally in milk. And in 2024, Team Milk is taking the next step to empower female runners by launching the only women's marathon in the U.S. designed for and by women. Built to be accessible, empowering, and community-building, the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon will take place in Savannah, Georgia, on November 16, 2024. You can learn more and register for the marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
I'm interested in how you went from, you know, history of science PhD to journalism. Like, were you always wired this way? And how did that wiring impact the choice to go from what I assume is sort of a path of academia to journalism?
Okay, do you want the long story or do you want the shorter story? I mean, I can tell you that nexus, but actually the thing I was doing in academia, I wasn't really trying to become an academic. It was trying to sort of duck I didn't know what else to do. And I just was like, I want to be a writer or something and I need something to write about. But it's also the...
It was trying to duck life.
Well, it was trying to duck life. It was also trying to duck the 2008 economic crisis where I was like, I'm not going to find a job. Like, I don't know what to do. And all the places I wanted to be a playwright and all the places that I applied to, they rejected me, all the playwriting grad schools. And then I was like, I don't know what to do. And I had this professor who I was a research assistant for. I was working basically for scholarship money. And he was like, why don't you just do the program I did, which is this history of science program, which I didn't really have any background in at all. And he was like, and the trick is if you apply for a master's degree, you have to pay them. But if you apply for a PhD, they pay you. But if you drop out of the PhD a year in, they give you a master's degree for free. So I was like, oh, that's a great idea. That's what I'm going to do. And then I applied for this PhD program, got in, and I just fell into this field and I just fell in love with it. And I got so excited about it. There were so many stories in this field, the history of science, that I felt like everybody ought to know. Like, they were stories that had the kind of philosophical profundity, the ambition, the universality of science, you know, but I had never really been able to get into science, like the sort of meticulousness and the kind of the lab work and all that. It never just clicked in my brain. But all of a sudden, history of science, it was like, oh, these are stories about people who are doing science or who did science or changed the way we all think. And it's like, oh, I can get on board with that. Like, that I get. And so I just fell in love with these stories. I would just tell my friends, I'll go out and be like, you cannot believe this. This is nuts. And I would tell my friends. And then I would like get so excited about them and I would write them up and I would submit them to like scholarly journals. And I would just get rejected over and over and over again. And I was like, okay, what do I do now? And at the time, I probably knew like maybe two podcasts, Radiolab being one of them. And I just, I liked their sensibility. And so I basically cold called or cold emailed the executive producer and was like, hey, I got a bunch of stories from the history of science. Like, I don't even know like how this goes, but you guys should do a story on this and on this and on this and on this. And I remember the stories I pitched first were like real dumb little things, but...
Do you remember any of them?
Yeah, so there was one about... Okay, so this was, remember, like around the time of the financial crisis, and I remembered this, I learned about this crazy thing. It was called cipher stroke, and it was this mental illness that... you can have these kinds of... and there's a more interesting question about whether they exist or not, whatever. This question of like time or culture delimited mental illnesses. And so one of them, it was called cipher stroke, and it was in Germany between the wars when, you know, when inflation was crazy. And, you know, the image of like people like carrying a wheelbarrow full of money to buy a loaf of bread or whatever. So they had crazy inflation, and there was this mental illness that developed in Germany around that time, where people, they would be completely kind of normal, living their days, having a healthy, normal life. And then the one thing that would sort of mess them up is that whenever it came to numbers, they were just all out of whack. So you'd ask someone like, how many kids do you have? And instead of saying, I have two kids, they'd say like, I have 210 million kids or something. Like, and it's just like crazy. Like and this was a thing that, you know, psychiatrists like noted enough to make an illness out of it. And I was like, oh, that's kind of interesting. Like we're in an economic crisis where people are talking in the millions and billions and stuff. And here's this weird factoid from the history of medicine that I can just tell you that's an interesting thing. Anyway, there was like not really a story there. It was just kind of a factoid. But anyway, so I just pitched a whole bunch of them and I was like, here. Here's some interesting things. And the executive producer, her name was Ellen Horn, a wonderful person for even taking my call, like, you know, off the street, basically. And she was like, no. But I haven't heard any of those pitches before. So just keep pitching us because those are interesting. Like I like them. So I just kind of kept pitching. And then I finally, one of my stories, they accepted one of my stories, which was like a real trip because it was one of those things where I remember where they were like, oh, you want to come into the studio and like talk about the story? And I was like, no, like, I don't know what to do. Like, it was one of those things where I was just pitching stories because that was the fun. And then I didn't know what came next or what I was supposed to do after that.
What was that meeting like?
Oh, it was terrifying. Like I had to tell the story that I pitched to Jad Abumrad and Robert Krulwich, who were both like people who I didn't even realize had fleshly bodies. and I just kind of told them the story the way I would have told, you know, a friend of mine or something. And it went great and they loved it, but it was super intimidating.
Did you practice?
Yeah, totally. Like I wrote up a whole script and memorized it and we went way off the script, but I acted like it was a play, like I was playwriting it, you know? But then, so they took that story, then they took, you know, months or even a year or whatever later, they took another. By that point, I'd been doing the same thing, like pitching stories to, I was in Boston, so the Boston Globe and other places. And yeah, and so I started, I was like, oh, I guess I'm a journalist now. not that I really knew kind of what that was about, but so I sort of stumbled into writing these like long form essays or doing long form stories. And I just loved it. And for me, it was like kind of like, I mean, it was journalism in a way, but it was also, it was like nonfiction playwriting, you know?
Help me understand what you mean by that. I didn't know that you had wanted to be a playwright, and I feel like some things are clicking for me now. But help me understand what you mean by that.
Okay, so to me, like if you go to see a play or you go to see a movie or you go to read a news story, you're kind of like, even though obviously some of these people are real people and some of these people are pretend people that you're reading about or seeing, watching or whatever, you as a viewer or a consumer or whatever, you're kind of expecting the same thing. Like stories have shapes, you know? Like you are following a main character and there's an inciting incident. You know, it's like one day this person was walking down the street and then they got hit by a anvil or whatever it is, right? There's an inciting incident and then that person, you know, there's some kind of a question or a quest that they go on and then they have some obstacles in trying to get to the bottom of that question or trying to sort of reach the fulfilling end of that quest. And there's these tribulations and then ultimately they kind of gain some nugget of wisdom and they're a different person by the end from where they started and they learn something and it all sort of, even if you're not, you don't have a kind of a total resolution, you want some kind of a, yeah, you want some reason to have gone on the journey. Like to me, that's like a very typical, like that shape is everywhere and mm-hmm. in every kind of story, nonfiction and fiction. And so you just have to find stories that sort of generally fit that shape and stories where you're actually kind of learning something along the way. And that's like, oh, okay, I could do that. Like, oh, okay, so I'm just playwriting, like, and I don't get as much authority to write other people's words, but it's still the same thing. Like, I get to choose who the characters in the story are. I get to decide when to start the story and when to end the story. I get to decide what's the moral of the story in the end, you know? Like, to me, these are all these kind of, I feel like I'm still playwriting. It's just, it's not in the theater.
Well, there's this other aspect of theater, though, right? So if you, like, came to journalism somewhat blind through Radiolab, like, there is this thing that's slightly different with radio journalism and particularly that kind of style of it. There's like an element of performance. Yeah, it's like slightly performative. I mean, not to get like too meta, but like, this is slightly performative,
yeah,
right? And like, I produce these podcasts and I spend time tracking with people, and it's kind of like more energy, you know?
Yeah.
Directions that feel not that dissimilar to what maybe a director of a play would encourage actors to do.
Yeah.
I mean, does that feel like connective tissue, or does it feel like I'm grabbing at straws?
No, I mean, I do think that that's right. But I do also think, so I did a story a while back on the history of Candid Camera, the show Candid Camera, which I love.
Oh, yeah, I remember that one.
Oh, yeah. But there's an idea in that episode, which is an idea that Alan Funt, the creator of Candid Camera, kind of, I forget whether it was the scholar who wrote about him or him himself, whatever, doesn't matter. But the idea was called bugging the backstage. So Candid Camera started as a radio show where there was a sort of someone in the booth interviewing somebody, you know, in the guest chair. And what he would do was there was like a little red recording light, and he would be like, he disabled the little red recording light. And then he was like, okay, we're just going to do a practice. And then he would just do the practice, but he would record the whole thing. And then he would tell the person after, hey, I recorded it. Is it cool if I use that? And not to say that I'm like up to any sleazy tactics or anything, but but to me, like, I do think it is a performance for sure. But in a way, in this like post-Candid Camera world, like, everything is kind of a performance. Like, I feel like the way that it's all, it's sort of sloshed around. Like, I don't think that there's not some like objective, true account of the world that if you put your camera in just the right place, you're going to capture. Like, it's all, it's all performance. Like, I think everything, these are all stories that we're weaving to tell each other to make sense of the world. Like, that's kind of the whole game. It's like chaos and death and like it's like in the face of the abyss. Like, we're telling ourselves these stories to pass the time and help make sense of it. And I think, to me, it's like inviting people to come and do their little dance. Sure. It's true. This is all performance. But how can I find the sort of truest moments and then script around that, you know?
Yeah. And that feels connected to playwriting, too.
Yeah, because I think it's like, even playwriting, even the most artificial story that gets made up, like, even the most, like, if you read a novel that's set in some fantastical future with orcs and robots or whatever, like, even that, for it to be worth, you know, a damn, it has to be anchored in real experience, like real life. It has to feel, there has to be something there that's sort of recognizably human, you know? And I think that that's the point of it. It's like, your story's not going to be any good if it's all made up. Like, it's true that truth is stranger than fiction, but like, you need the truth, whether it's in fiction or nonfiction, you need that truth to sort of ground you and to make it something that people actually lean into and feels like hooks into their lives, you know, or hooks into their selves.
So eventually, you figure out how to be doing like playwriting on the radio and do a bunch of stories
real people,
for Radiolab.
Yeah.
With real people playwriting on the radio, and then end up as the director of research at Radiolab. What does that mean?
No, it's nothing. It was a totally made up job. Like, it was a made up job title. It had no meaning whatsoever. But the thing was that one of the things they brought me in as was to kind of build out the fact checking at Radiolab. And I had been, as a in grad school, the way I, like, a job that I had was being a research assistant. So I got really good at finding stuff. That was, like, I think the biggest and best thing I got out of grad school was sort of an ability to, yeah, to look beyond Google in a way.
Yeah.
And so when they hired me, it was basically like, okay, why don't you do a producer stuff? But also, since you're good at footnoting and stuff, like, why don't you actually footnote everything we make and do fact checking? And so at the beginning, I was the fact checker for Radiolab. And so I would go over, like, with a fine tooth comb, every single line of every single episode. And then soon after, we got, like, freelance fact checkers who work with us, who are, like, exceptionally good. But at the beginning, it was just me. And I was like, oh, okay, how do I do this? And it was really hard, and stressful. Oh my God, stressful. But I learned a lot.
Yeah, it sounds so daunting.
It's so stressful. Oh my God. Fact checkers, they are, I feel like, almost single-handedly going to save our republic here. They are so important and good, but it is such a, it's like a toxic job because it requires all this, like, to feel like you're on the line in a way for something that, you know, a reporter you just met yesterday is saying, and you're like, how would I know, like, if that's true or not? This thing that I heard about, you know, a topic that I never thought about until this very minute, you know? They do, like, God's work, fact checkers.
Did it feel like a thing that you could only do for so long because it was so stressful?
Oh, yeah. I was like, get me out of here. I was like begging to get off the fact check desk. Like when I watch the presidential debates or whatever, like all the fact checkers, I'm like, oh my, it was stressful for me. I was doing like a long form thing where I had lots of time. Like this is like these are people who we need to like support, like essential workers or something.
So at that point in your career, like help me understand what you were thinking about wanting to do. So it's like fact checking is deeply, deeply stressful. You're only like a handful of years into doing nonfiction playwright journalism.
Yeah.
Like where were you at? What did you want to be doing? What were your like ambitions then?
I'm like, the way my brain works, I had no 5-year, 10-year, I had no plans really. A lot of people, they go to a show and they're like, oh, one day I'm going to host my own show, or I'm going to start my own show, or I'm going to do this, or I'm going to do that. I had none of that. For me, it was like to find a place, like a home with a lot of other like weird, interesting people, like who can kind of like bat ideas back and forth with me. And then also like in a podcast, to have like a container for my stories and ideas that I can kind of just, and also to work with people who like, between the editors, the composers, the fact checkers, the this people, the that people, like to have a team where it's like, oh, this story, like it's so much better than I could have ever made it by myself. Like if I had made this story by myself, it would be a shadow of kind of the thing that I got to make. And so Radiolab, I was just kind of content there. Like I was like, I'm happy to keep doing this forever. Like here's a fun container. Here's my smart weirdo work family. And here's like the stories that come out the other end are like something that I'm actually quite proud of and are better than I could have made on my own, you know?
Can we talk a little bit about finding stories?
Sure.
It feels like that's part of what you were working on then too. You know, you've got this piece on Transom, I think from last year, sort of about like the like Latif Bible of story finding.
Yeah, right.
How did you arrive at that? What is your theory of story finding at this
point? Sure. To me, I think so much of it is about the framing of it. Like, it's like before you go start to find a story, it's like, what is the nature of knowledge and stories? Like, there's this one thing that one of my professors when I was in grad school, his name's Hisa Kuriyama, he told me, and it still echoes in my head like more than 10 years later. He said, it's not that 99.9% of the most interesting questions in the world haven't been answered. It's that 99.9% of the most interesting questions in the world haven't even been asked yet. And like this feeling that it's like, we think we're so smart. We think we can fill all these pages of all these newspapers with stories. But like really, we are just like the amount that we know is like a penny. It's nothing. And there are just like stories all around us, you know, that for whatever like filter biases we have, we miss constantly. And so to me, the way to find stories is to sort of hack that filter, you know, and it's like, you know, you look at all the different front pages of so many newspapers, they'll all be the same story. Like, you know, the New York Times thing, all the news that's fit to print. Like, there's no way there's all the news that's fit to print in one day on planet Earth with 7.5 billion people, not to mention like corporations and birds and microbes and this and that and the other thing. Like, there's no way. There's no way this number of pages is going to encapsulate all of that for 24 hours on planet Earth. And that's just planet Earth. There's a lot of other planets. There's a lot of other galaxies.
This is my question, though. It seems to me, and maybe I'm wrong, it just seems to me like that's just like in you somewhere. And so did you have to hack that frame for yourself or not? And if so, it's like, how do other people hack it?
Yeah, I think to me, grad school was a big hack on that. Like, I remember one of the first exercises we had in grad school, there was like a methods seminar or whatever. And one of the things we did is like, the assignment was like, go look at a newspaper from whatever year, I forget what year it was, like, it might have been 1950 or there was one where we did it. And it was like a colonial America newspaper or whatever it was. And when you look at those newspapers, one of the things that I remember when I was doing that exercise, was it on microfilm? I think it was on microfilm. And so you're going through and then you look at the list of bestsellers, right? From 1950, whatever. And what you realize is like you've heard of none of them, zero mm-hmm. of them. Mm-hmm. These were the bestsellers, some that had been on the charts for so many weeks in a row that all the people in the whole country had been talking about, buzzing about, obsessing about. We've never heard of any of them. Like, just because they're not Googleable, you know what I mean? Like, we think we know so much, but we don't. Like, we are so forgetful. We're so myopic. We're so self-centered. We're so, like, it's like all of these are filters, you know? And it's like, how do you... Sorry for there's so many mixed metaphors here. If people are picking those low-hanging fruits, right, of stories, like it's like, oh, okay, that's easy. That's a story. And then you're like, okay, and I see that, you know, it gets picked up and it's in every newspaper or whatever. It's like, how do I then, like a monkey, climb up the tree, do a backflip to this branch that nobody's been on, and oh man, there's a whole like bounty of fruits nobody's ever even heard of, like up there, right. But only because we've all been just stripping these same branches right at the bottom, you know?
Yeah, and it's, I mean, I guess that connecting to the sort of penny idea, it's only 0.001% that can be on the front page. Like, it just, like, just the law of the math,
right,
is that it can only be this absolute surface. And if you can just find a way to look elsewhere or on the branch that you've backflipped to as a monkey, there could be all kinds of things there. And I guess the question I'm trying to ask is like, if you don't see the world that way, mm-hmm. if you are a low-hanging fruit person, right? If you didn't go to grad school, if you never gone back and looked at a newspaper from 1950, what is the way that people can do that more in their work? What is the hack? Or is it just like waking up every morning with a picture of a tree?
I really do think that people have, like, and you probably know this too, having kids, like, I think we're all born with it. It's not a crazy thing. Like, we all are born and then we're kids and we ask dumb questions all the time. Questions that are, you know, and I think we all have them in us. And it's like listening, turning up the volume on those stupid questions that you ask. To me, yeah, it's just like jettisoning these assumptions, like news. Like, I find it such a funny thing. Like, it's like, and granted, it would take a history grad student maybe to say this, but it's like, you think just because something's new, it's important or interesting or is going to change your mind or perspective? Or like, no, in fact, it's the opposite. Like, to me, it's like, oh, let's actually, like, let's look at stories that have been around for a while that mm-hmm. actually, like, that probably exert more of an influence or are somehow more illuminating or we've actually had time to think about and digest. Like, to me, that, I don't know, there's so many, like, filter biases that work in the wrong direction. And to me, the thing to do is turn up the volume on your dumb questions, on your, like, Wikipedia surfing, on your, like, imaginative curiosity and follow that. And maybe, you know, 9 times out of 10, you'll go to a totally absurd place that nobody cares about. But one time you'll find a story that you're like, how is nobody, like, why am I alone here? How is nobody else paying attention to this story?
It is about getting in touch with your own dumb questions. And I feel like there's like a slight elephant in the room in this conversation, which is that the grad school that you keep like praising is Harvard. You're
correct.
A Harvard PhD.
Yeah.
And maybe this is unfair and stereotypical, but I would assume that most Harvard PhDs would be significantly less comfortable than you are making a career out of asking questions that are somewhere between simple and dumb. I mean, I feel like your work is totally based in this idea of not assuming you know anything.
Yeah.
Which runs so counter to like my concept of a Harvard PhD. And I don't really even have a question. It's just like that gap is interesting to me. And it's so clear in the radio stuff. It's all so clear in like the TV show. You know, it's just the whole show is kind of you being like, how does that work? And most people, I think, are just really, really uncomfortable with being seen as dumb.
Yeah, it's. I think there's an ego thing to it. And in a way, I feel like I definitely, like, having a Harvard PhD helps you get over that speed bump of ego. But I don't think you need it. Like, we should be able to walk into a thing and say, look, if you have the genuine commitment to learn and the kind of intellectual humility to say that you don't already know the answer, like, I think every story is open to you.
Can you learn that?
I think you definitely practice. And like, asking a dumb question, oh my God, it's like, to a smarty, is hard. Like, it takes a bunch of times, like, working up to it and writing it out ahead of time. And, like, because, I don't know, we all don't want to seem dumb. There's this sort of self-preservation. But, like, we are dumb. Like, all of us, necessarily. Like, the machinery we have in our head is not enough. As impressive as it is, it's not enough to fathom even a drop of the ocean. You know what I mean? Like, you're dumb. It's okay. Like, be okay with that. And that's the first step to actually, like, to me, to kind of having your own mind blown, and then being able, in turn, as a storyteller, as a journalist, as a playwright, as a whatever, to blowing minds of other people. There's also just one last thing I want to say about the dumb questions, if I can.
Great. Yeah.
Dumb questions, it is a thing. You should do it. Like, we all should. Even in our lives, I think it's like a really valuable thing. But there's something paired with it, which is like an earnest desire to learn, and a kind of a humility that is not like making fun of, or kind of like trying to undermine, or like sarcastically rip on, you know, the person who's been like generous enough to like give you their time and brain, you know? And if you have that, like, I feel like even the smartiest of smart people, even the snootiest of snooty people, like, if you can kind of win them over and convince them that, oh, hey, I'm actually here to learn. Like, I'm not here to waste your time. Like somehow that it's powerful and important, and it lets the other stuff happen, you know?
The other way that I think about that, it's just interesting what you just said, because I've been confused for a long time about why earnestness is like bad. Yeah. Like, being earnest is kind of like a pejorative.
Yeah.
And I'm genuinely confused as to why.
Yeah. Oh, I feel like I get ripped on that a lot. Like, and it's like this feeling, it's like, oh, you're like a simpleton or something, or you can't like manage two different tones or registers or ideas at the same time or something. Like, it's like, oh, this is, and also like, it's also true that like at a time when facts are complicated and ideas are like, they can cut in ways that you can't even expect. Like,
it vaguely feels like the apocalypse.
Yeah, the apocalypse. Yeah. Right, exactly. Like, it's like then coming out and being like, hey, like, frogs are cool, or whatever it is, right? Like, it just feels inadequate for this moment or something. And I get that. But I do think you're right. Like, earnestness, like, to me, that's how I approach the world. And like, it's how I want to engage with the world. Like, maybe it's just a temperament thing or something. I don't know.
I think the other version of dumb question is just like, it's not dumb. It's just shorter. It's like literally just simpler.
Yeah.
It's not dumb. It's like not forcing your own knowledge into it. They're different things.
Yeah. A friend of mine who's a math teacher, he said this once to me, and I think about it all the time. He's like, there are two kinds of teachers. There's one kind of teacher that like actually wants you to learn and like is excited to give you this gift. And there's another kind of teacher who just like wants to show off how much they know. And it's like that difference is a really crucial difference. Like, where it's like, oh, yeah. I actually want to know, or I want the world to know. And here's this quick question, because it's like, this is the thing I'm thinking. What do you think? As opposed to like, well, if you read the da-ba-da-ba-da, as I will have argued elsewhere, da-ba-da-ba-da, and then you're like, okay, yeah, yeah.
All right, you got to go talk to a very small baby very soon, but I'm interested in how that sort of like a combination of willingness to sort of admit what you don't know and curiosity to figure it out, it feels like that's like such a natural pairing with Radiolab, right? I just make sense. Like, that is the vessel into which that kind of like sensibility and tone and curiosity is like best suited. But I'm interested in how it fits for you with the other Latif, with that series that you did. Did that feel distinct to you? Did it feel different, or did it feel totally of a piece of the rest of your work?
Yeah. To me, that story was unlike anything I've done. And in a way, I did, as we've already been talking about, like, I spend so much of my time and so much of the joy of my life is finding stories. And yet, this was the first time it felt like a story like found me, chose me, and I couldn't not tell it. And it wasn't something in my wheelhouse. It wasn't a thing I was sort of comfortable with, to be honest. Like I hate like Muslim terrorist tropes and stories and in fiction and nonfiction and anywhere. Like I hate torture scenes in TV shows. I hate all of this stuff. Like it's not something that I ever want to make more of and put into the world. And yet it felt like this story grabbed me, and I was like, I cannot do something about this.
Just before we get any further, can you give the like very quick synopsis of it?
Sure. So the kind of start of it was that I was on Twitter one day. I was procrastinating. I saw someone tweeting about me to the president of the United States. I was like, what? What? I did not understand the tweet. It turned out it was not about me. It was about a guy who had my same name and who happened to be a detainee 244 at Guantanamo Bay. And I had never heard of this guy. I didn't know anything about him. But all of a sudden, I needed to know everything about him. And the first thing, one of the first things I found was this WikiLeaked document about him from the Department of Defense, which had this kind of like, basically like a rap sheet where it said that he was Al-Qaeda's top explosives expert. He was a military aide to Osama bin Laden. He blew up the famous UNESCO World Heritage Site, the Bamiyan Buddha statues. He did, you know, just a real kind of a rogue's CV. And then after that, I connected with his defense attorney, who told me, no, 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 this guy is totally innocent. He was never in Al-Qaeda, didn't know bin Laden, was just at the wrong place at the wrong time, and got swept up by the Northern Alliance and then sold for a bounty to the United States. And he has been in American custody for, if you count now, almost 19, 20 years without a trial, without charges. And on top of that, in 2016, he was cleared to go home back to Morocco unanimously by a bunch of sort of career civil servants working under the Obama administration. He was freed to go home, and he just, for some mysterious paperwork kind of a reason, he did not go home. And so he's still there in Guantanamo Bay, despite the fact that sort of on paper, he's free to go home.
It's really complicated.
It's a very complicated story.
It's a hard story. And I imagine it's a really hard story to tell.
Yeah.
So when you say like it grabbed you and wouldn't let go, like you had to do it.
Yeah.
What does that mean? It seems like an easier one to not do to me is maybe what I'm asking. You know what I mean?
And it's funny. I like looked back at when I first pitched it in the Radiolab pitch meeting. I looked back at the like meeting notes from that meeting, and it had four comments. One was, don't do it. It seems dangerous. One was, I don't know, miscarriage of justice at Guantanamo doesn't seem super surprising. Let's not do it. And then the other two were me trying to like gin up more interest in it and failing. But yeah, so it was a story that like, I feel like a lot of people were like, nah, just pass. But to me, it was several things. One, this guy has my name. Like names to me are very important. Names to me are really, really special. Like you get your name at the same time as you get your life. Like, that's important. So that was something. And then the fact that, like, really nobody besides this guy's lawyer and, like, one activist, a guy named Andy Worthington, had written about this guy at all. At all. It felt like, and if I ignored him, like, he was just going to keep sitting there. And maybe he was cleared, or maybe he was innocent. And he was just there forever without a trial. It felt like, in a way, such a weird analogy, it felt like there was like a bat signal that was like flashed up with my name, and like only I could see it. And it was like, this guy, he needed my help, but I didn't even know if he, like, does this guy deserve my help? Is he worthy of my help? Like, but I don't even really know either way. But it was like this bat signal that only I could see. And it turns out, actually, a bunch of other reporters had been around the same time working on a story about this guy anyway, but I didn't know that. And for me, it was like, if I don't do something about this guy, like who is going to do? It's been over 15 years and nobody has written anything about this guy in any major publication. There's no reason for me to believe that this guy is going to get any kind of a fair shake, any kind of a due process, any kind of a thing that I would want if I was in his place. And it was very easy for me to imagine being in his place because he had my same name, you know?
So you felt almost like a moral responsibility to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. And not because I actively did not want to do it. And I then felt like no one else is gonna. And that just seems like that's too wrong. Like, it's too wrong.
He's still there.
Yeah. I think about it all the time. I think about him all the time. And I still have sort of complicated feelings about what he may have done or not did, what I even can know about him. I've never been able to talk to him. I've never been able to hear his voice. I so desperately want to. But I think about him all the time. Like, there was this one time we went to this, my wife and I went to this really fancy, I'll just say it. My wife is a TV writer and she got nominated for an Emmy. So we went to the Emmys. And I was wearing like a tuxedo and we were both like, I was so proud of my wife. And we went and like still like that whole night, I was like, how am I at the, I'm like in a tuxedo at the Emmys and there's a guy with my name in Guantanamo Bay. Like I could not shake that the whole night. I was like, what the hell? Like, this doesn't make any sense. Like it felt so absurd. And like just all the time, I'm like, oh, that whole day that I spent doing, yeah, like that guy was in Guantanamo Bay and didn't have a trial. And like there's, right. It feels like no legal, reasonable justification for him to be there. And I know there are many more and even worse miscarriages of justice out there. Somehow the fact that this guy had my name and that there was sort of enough about his life story that allowed me to kind of like hook into his story and imagine myself in it, it just grabbed me in a way.
And has it changed at all having done it?
No. I like think about him all the time. I still write letters to him and to his lawyers. It's also weird because I know through his lawyers that he thinks about me a lot. And he's a science nerd too. Like, and even the work that I do that's not about him, his lawyers were like, hey, can you get your TV show on a DVD for us so that I could get it past the like Guantanamo censors to get to him? Because he really, like, he's a science nerd. He loves that kind of thing. Like, he'd love it. And so I'm like, so he's like, I'm obsessed with him. He's obsessed with me. We're not allowed to talk. We've never been allowed to talk. And he's in this kind of crazy, precarious situation. Yeah, I just want to talk to this guy. I just want to interview this guy. I just want to kind of understand him and this kind of insane life journey he went on.
So this story sort of like bat signals to you. It doesn't actually fit exactly with the kind of work that you're normally doing. It's complicated. It's hard to find real resolution in it. You pour yourself into it anyway. You put out this like completed series, but then it's just all the same still.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, like, in addition to that, this was the, like, I work hard on every story I do, and I have for, you know, since I started being a journalist, like, but this is the only time when I've gotten personal. Only time. The only time I've ever kind of talked about myself more than just like, oh, hey, I'm a neat, interesting guy who's interested in a lot of things. Like, this was a time where I sort of dug deep. Like, I really, like, I carved out a lot of myself and, like, had to do a lot of, like, almost like therapy between myself and the producers who were closest with me, Sara Khari and Susie Lechtenberg. Like, I would send them like long, like every night. Like, I feel like I would like write and like send them. I like worked so hard on the story. And you're right. Like, it came out the pandemic. Like, it was literally the day after our final episode launched, like at night. And then the morning after that, we had a team Radiolab meeting where it was like, okay, this is a state of editorial emergency. We're covering COVID now. Let's do this. It was like not even an hour of like, oh, okay, like what does this mean? What effect did this have in the world? Like, it was a weird thing where it was like nothing really has changed, but maybe something will change at the ballot box. And like, I think that the U.S. government made a sort of a pledge to this guy to do this thing, and whether it's going to get done or not really will depend on the election and which way that will go. We can't know, obviously, for now, but I just don't know what's going to happen. And I think about it all the time, and I think about it for me, but now I also think about it for him.
It's an interesting note for you to end on. You have to go take care of your child now.
I do.
But I have one more question, which was actually not a question I came up with. I talked to a colleague of yours and was like, I'm going to interview Latif. Is there anything you want to know? And they were like, does he ever get mad? Does he ever get mad? Which I was like, oh man, that's actually a great question. Like, I've consumed all of this person's work. It's very hard for me to imagine him getting mad. That's kind of like an endearing thing that you also are wondering that and you know him so well.
That's so funny that a coworker said that. Yeah, no, because it's true. I never get mad. I get sad. I like turn in on myself and crumple and get disappointed and depressed and stuff. But I don't get mad really. Because I just think it's like I feel like fury, like righteous fury or anger, it requires a level of like certitude that you know what to get mad at. And I feel like I never have that. Like, I think it's like, I don't know. I don't stand firm enough anywhere to like look down on someone and like get mad at them or get mad at like a, I don't know, whatever. Yeah, I just get sad. I never get mad.
If you don't know 99.99% of what there is to know in the world, how can you possibly get mad about the 0.001% you know?
Yeah, I don't know. That's kind of how I feel. Like, it's, I'm trying to think of the last time I got mad.
Well, here's the thing, though. It's like, you just sounded a little mad that Latif Nasser is still in Gitmo.
Yeah. Yeah, right. It's a kind of it's a mad, sad cocktail. Yeah, I guess that's the closest I get. Like, I get really frustrated sometimes about the world. I mean, and it hurts. Like, you take a hit and you're like, oh, that wasn't what I expected or wanted or wished that the world was like, or what this person was like that I admire or whatever it is. But then you kind of stumble back and you get you drink your mad, sad cocktail. And then I think it just takes remembering like, oh, I am tiny. This is tiny. The world is big. There are many other things. There are many other things to fall in love with, to get excited about, to marvel at. Like, there are other things out there. And that's sort of a Zen thing to say. And it's a weird time to say it, like at a time where it's the opposite. It's like, get mad, go out, like be an activist, do this, do that. That's like just not my constitution. Like, I'm just like, okay, let me go find another thing that I can just like, another shell I can polish or something, you know? Like, it's just, I feel like the different reporters are built for different moments. I feel like I'm not built for this moment of like, get like righteous, angry and go out and do something. Like, to me, it's like, oh, that's really sad. I should do a story about that, but that's like really depressing. And how do I, oh, but look at this other shiny thing over here. Like, it's that, that's me.
Look at this frog.
Look at this frog. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, Latif, thank you for, taking some moments, man. I appreciate it.
You are such a class act, and I'm so flattered still that you asked me to chat.
Thanks for listening to Longform. I'm Max Linsky. My co-hosts are Aaron Lammer and Evan Ratliff. Our editor is Janelle Pfeiffer, and our intern is Susan Peterson. Thanks to them. Thanks to our sponsors, MailChimp, for continuing to make this show possible. And thanks so much to Latif Nasser for, I'll say this. It's a tough time. It's not a good time. Talking to Latif, good time. I had a good time. We'll see you next week.
Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Cult Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.